I found this mind-boggling, the yeah. idea that, you know, at the end of this day, 110 creatures will have disappeared.
So there's a strong connection for you between the bestiary and the extinction, sort of as though we should start creating bestiaries of our own as the animals that we know move into extinction and become mythical.
Exactly. That's exactly right. I realized after a while that animals that you and I might have known or have seen or known of as children, your children will know of only as stories, and children beyond them will know of really as myths. And then in a way, some of these books perhaps really did chronicle animals that had come and gone.
One of the things I love about your book is the little shards of magical realism that run through. And there are a couple of little sections, maybe the part where Zeno, your main character, is describing his grandmother.
Okay. My grandmother had strong connections to the animal spirits in the house. At times I thought I heard her talking to herself in Italian, only to realize she was conversing with creatures invisible to me. When I inquired, she muttered words like lupo, struzzo, drago, which I soon learned meant wolf, ostrich, and dragon. She believed these spirits were everywhere. Billions, trillions of animals had come and gone on this earth, she liked to say. So how could it be otherwise? When we went for walks in the park, she talked about the animals she saw embodied in other people. The animals those people had been in previous lives. In crowds, my grandmother picked out wolves and vultures, rats and tigers. Piccione, she murmured as we left the park, pointing to a stone bench where in gray coats with darting, beady eyes, pigeon-like old men were tossing birdseed to pigeons.
She's a wonderful character. Does that come out of anything in your own life? Did you have anybody in your own life who told you stories about animals?
I did. You know, I had a grandmother who told me stories, who believed in her dreams and that things happened in dreams that could tell you things you didn't know about what were happening in everyday life. And she loved fables. So she's not quite as clairvoyant as the grandmother in this book, but she was someone who fascinated me with storytelling from the time I was very small. On countless nights after tucking me in, my grandmother retired to her bed and told me animal stories, punctuated by sound effects out of the darkness. I heard about the one-winged stork that flew over the Alps and laid an egg from which an entire city was born, and the serpent that ate the moon and spat out a sky full of stars. Late one night after she finished one of her stories, the stray headlight of a passing car shone through the window, and I was stunned to see not my grandmother, but a red fox with a ring of white fur around its neck, stretched out on her bed. I cried out, and Ray started barking. A moment later, the lamp came on, and there was my grandmother sitting up in bed. She was wearing a red nightdress with a white shawl around her shoulders. "It's all right, child," she murmured, coming over and laying her palm against my cheek. "You were dreaming." The next morning, I found a white whisker on the floor. Ray's whiskers were black, and it was too long to have come from the cat that visited us. I saved the whisker, keeping it inside a silver music box that once belonged to my grandmother.
Wonderful.
Thank you.
Oh, I love that business with the fox, who shows up again later in the book. And then I noticed in the glossary, there's a fox legend from Japan, a kitsune.
There are a lot of foxes in these mythologies. The kitsune was the one that always concealed its bushy tail and often assumed the body of a beautiful woman, and its tail was hidden. Many of the Japanese and Chinese foxes were tricksters, and they would come, for example, the ones that weren't beautiful women would often be unscrupulous attorneys or what barristers at the time were realtors, a guy who would come and sell you a house and give you a deed, and you would be buying an incredible mansion, and he'd show it to you up on a hill. And then at the last minute, you'd see that he had a tail coming out of his coat, and you'd look up the hill and the mansion would be gone and he would run away. I mean, there are hundreds of myths like that.
Why don't we have mythological animals anymore, do you think?
I don't know if it's just that science has defeated that part of our imagination. If someone would just say, well, that can't be. You can't have a parrot and you can't have a beast that's half deer and half eagle. I don't know. I think part of it would be that our imaginations have become so scoured in some ways by science, and that you know, the fantastic is always thought to be scientifically based at this point, whereas to more ancient men, there were no explanations like that. They could invent the explanations.
Do you think the world has become, or our human faculties have become less filled with wonder?
Well, I think so. I think as we become more passive, the scene in the book that you liked with the fox where we're in a forest and the whole place is coming alive, to work on that, I realized I had to transmit this to people who are very visually oriented from movies and television, where you can have special effects and all kinds of things happen visually and think, well, sure, you can do anything with a computer. I'm not one of these people who laments the end of reading and the end of books and this and that, but I think it's true that there's a passivity, imaginative passivity, where we just expect things to be rolled out before us, and I think that's one explanation.